You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson. Coming up, scientists have announced the detection of gravitational waves coming from the collision of two neutron stars, and a team of UW-Milwaukee researchers played a big role in the project. We'll hear about their work and how the discovery could change the way we look at space.
Right now, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa will collar gray wolves in an effort to learn more about pack movements in northern Wisconsin.
The move comes amid growing tensions around the gray wolf and whether they should be delisted as an endangered species. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, JC.
So what led to the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa wanting to take on the project of collaring these wolves?
Well, they want to understand a little bit more about the behavior and prey of the gray wolf. There are about six packs that move through the reservation and the Bayfield Peninsula, and so that they want to just be able to better understand how they're using the reservation, how they're also using timber harvests, how they're using the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, because they have had some wolf sightings out on the islands. So it's just an effort for them to gain more understanding of the wolves that are moving around the reservation and what they're doing there.
And so these wolves in, you know, this part of the state, they at one point had a much smaller population. It seems as though the wolf population is growing a little bit more. So why look at this data now?
And they're looking at it because there was a grant opportunity available to them through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. There's an endangered species program that allows money for them to explore issues like this. And I think right now with the current conversation about delisting versus relisting the wolf as an endangered species in the Western Great Lakes, they wanted to take advantage of this time to better understand the gray wolf and how it uses the area. They want to know whether these wolves are harassing bear dogs, whether they're harassing cattle or livestock on nearby farms, to just kind of get a better idea of whether or not they are problem wolves or what their actual behaviors are, what's the frequency of the interaction, and just be able to pinpoint where they are at any given time.
Yeah, and I want to get back to sort of the controversy surrounding the gray wolf in just a second. But, you know, the data that they are looking for right now with the movements and stuff, this seems like a really specific project that the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa is pursuing. How is it different than what, you know, the State Department of Natural Resources already does?
Sure. Yeah. Right now, there is or has been collaring of wolves ever since, I believe, the 70s in the state of Wisconsin. And usually the DNR does weekly flyovers to obtain information on all of these collared wolves. But right now they're using VHF collars. And according to the tribe, they only are able to obtain data from the DNR once a week through these flyovers to pinpoint where the location of these wolves are that have been collared. So they have been able to obtain, through this funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, satellite collars, and that will allow them to track the location of the wolves every 25 minutes versus just once a week. So for Red Cliff, it's going to give them much finer scale data on the movements of these wolves. And they can also, from this data, be able to get clusters from these points and investigate, you know, if these locations are a kill site, if it's a den site where wolves are reproducing, or if it's a rendezvous site for the packs. And that'll just help them to better understand behaviors and where they're moving, and maybe even potentially avoid some sort of conflict with livestock or bear dogs.
Yeah, it seems as though the State Department of Natural Resources has been, you know, working on sites that alert hunters or people who might be walking that there have been sort of dog and, you know, wolf interactions. So I guess what have the tribes said about that?
I think everyone is keeping track of these sites where there is the potential for conflicts, where they have wolves that have been known to be in this area, and there have been problems, whether it be with farms or with hunters. So the DNR provides that information So it gives hunters a better idea in the fall, you know, if they're out hunting for bears, you know, maybe you don't want to go into this area in Bayfield County or Douglas County because nearby there have been conflicts with wolves in the area. So I think the DNR has been providing that information to help reduce the number of conflicts, and that in turn reduces also the amount the state would potentially have to pay out in depredation payments, which kind of reached, I want to say it reached a record level last year at around $200,000, and this year, by mid-year, it had already reached almost that point. So they're trying to obtain and present whatever information possible at the state level to prevent these types of conflicts from happening.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She is based in Superior, and she's with us to talk about a new project that the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are doing, where they are attaching satellite collars to gray wolves in that area. So, Danny, we touched on this just a few minutes ago. There has been a lot of debate about whether or not wolves should be protected at the federal level or if the states should have jurisdiction. Many lawmakers have said that it should be up to the state in particular to manage gray wolf populations. What is the current legal status of wolves in the state?
Well, in the western Great Lakes states, or Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the gray wolf has been placed back on the endangered species list. So congressional lawmakers have been advocating to delist the gray wolf ever since it was placed back on the list in December of 2014 after a federal judge ruled it needed to be protected. There's a provision right now, if the legislation passed, that it could no longer withstand a court challenge, you know, whether it was delisted. Because over the last couple decades or so, we've seen the gray wolf listed and delisted. And that kind of back and forth creates a lot of uncertainty for not only state natural resources managers and how they should manage the wolf, but they just want to be able to give everyone involved an idea of the certainty, I think, is what the lawmakers are trying to do. Farmers and hunters are pushing for delisting because obviously wolf attacks on livestock and hunting dogs aren't good for them, and it costs the state money. However, tribal and wolf advocates say the animal hasn't recovered to its historic range. I mean, right now we're nearing around 1,000 wolves in Wisconsin, but they say that that's just a fraction of the population before.
With these conversations, which again are fraught, is there any middle ground? You've been covering this for a while. Have you seen any middle ground between the two?
Well, it kind of depends, right, on who's looking at the issue. I think for tribes, there is no middle ground. They want to see the wolf protected because that animal is like their brother. Mm-hmm. They consider the wolf a brother, and it's their responsibility to protect that animal. If you look at it from the point of view of farmers and hunters versus, you know, folks with the Humane Society who want to protect animals, I think there's a little bit more give and take there. I think that the Humane Society of the United States, the state director here, Melissa Tedrow, would be willing to see the wolf listed as threatened and therefore allow lethal control, or basically kill problem wolves when they occur, which can't happen right now when it's on the endangered species list. You can't kill the gray wolf. They think that that would provide the kind of flexibility that farmers and hunters have desired, you know, to address issues where their livestock or their animals have been attacked on a regular basis, and other types of methods like using lights.
So looking at this project in particular, the one that the Lake Superior Chippewa, the Red Cliff Band is undertaking, logistically, what are they hoping to do?
So what they're hoping to do is put a collar, ideally they would put a satellite collar on a wolf in each of the 6 wolf packs. But for this fall, they are starting to trap and collar wolves in the Little Sioux River and Echo Valley packs on the Bayfield Peninsula. As of this past May, there were about 13 wolves in that Echo Valley pack. So they're hoping to trap and collar these wolves this fall and to do more as funding becomes available. And those collars will last about 2 to 3 years. So they'll have about 2 to 3 years worth of information about the location of these wolves moving on the peninsula.
Danny, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, JC.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She joined us to talk about efforts by the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa to collect more data on the gray wolf population in northern Wisconsin.
First, the Nobel Prize for Physics this year was recently awarded to researchers who successfully detected gravitational waves back in 2015. It was the first time that researchers had been able to measure the ripples in space-time that were theorized by Albert Einstein a century ago. And playing a key role in that research was a team of scientists from UW-Milwaukee.
UWM was also involved in a discovery announced just this morning. Gravitational waves measured earlier this year came from the collision of 2 neutron stars. That was the first time that the detection of waves has been matched with a burst of visible light from deep space.
Patrick Brady is a professor and director of the Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at UW-Milwaukee. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to get into this new discovery in a bit, but first let's get to the basics. What are gravitational waves?
Well, Einstein invented a theory of gravity nearly 100 years ago, and he explains gravity as the curvature of space-time. So his equations, they relate this curvature to the matter that's in the universe. And he tells us in his equations that matter tells space-time how to curve, and curvature tells matter how to move. So if you take as a consequence of that, what happens when you take, say, your fist and you close it and you shake it really fast, when you do that, you're shaking matter around, and what you cause is these ripples of curvature to move outwards from your shaking fist. Now, those ripples in curvature, they're kind of like the ripples on the surface of a pond where a rock is thrown in. So you throw the rock in and the ripples on the surface propagate outwards from the point of entry of the rock. Well, the waves propagate away from your fist as you shake them. Now, the real question then becomes, how do you know that a gravitational wave has gone by? And the answer to that question comes from the fact that as a gravitational wave passes, it squeezes space-time in one direction and stretches it in the perpendicular direction. And then as the wave goes by, that stretching and squeezing alternates so that you end up squeezed and stretched, and then it goes back to stretched and squeezed, and that keeps alternating back and forth as the wave passes.
Now, Albert Einstein had the math to figure out gravitational waves, but not the technology to measure them. Can you talk about what we have now that was able to successfully measure gravitational waves just a couple of years ago?
Yeah, so the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, a rather big mouthful that we shorten to LIGO, is a pair of gravitational wave detectors, one in Hanford in Washington and one in Livingston in Louisiana. And what they do is they are instruments where they have 2 perpendicular arms. At the ends of the 2 arms, which are 4 kilometers each long, so about 3 miles each long, they hang mirrors. And then what you do is you shine a laser beam down the 2 arms to measure the length of each of them. It reflects off the mirror at the end and comes back. And if there are any deviations or any changes in the relative lengths of each of the arms, that shows up as a signal when you recombine the laser light. So we basically use lasers to measure the stretching and squeezing of space-time as the gravitational wave passes.
So that's pretty cool. Now, how do you and your team at UW-Milwaukee help with this research?
Well, we've been involved in the search for gravitational waves for about 22 years. And we started out in different ways. One member of the group, Alan Wiseman, first calculated the expected waves from things like pairs of neutron stars. He was one of the early people to do those calculations and try to figure out what the waves would be like when we measure them here on the Earth. Over time, we've become more and more involved in the analysis of the data taken by the LIGO detectors, but also taken by a partner detector called Virgo in Europe. So we build the computing systems and we design the data analysis procedures so that we can search through this data for very minute signals of gravitational waves that are hidden and buried under the noise. And we pull them out so that we can know that a gravitational wave has gone by. So that's our primary role. And then we are heavily involved in the interpretation of the results, which we can speak a little bit about later when we talk about the neutron stars.
We're talking to Patrick Brady from the UW-Milwaukee. He's director of the Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics. We're talking about his work and his colleagues' work on detecting gravitational waves. And Patrick, let's get into that neutron star. The news out this morning officially of a pretty amazing thing that happened earlier this year involving two neutron stars, apparently. Talk us through what happened.
Well, so on August 17th at around 8 a.m. Central Time, the gravitational waves from the merger of a pair of neutron stars passed by the Earth, and they were measured by the two LIGO detectors, and as it turns out, not measured by the partner one in Italy. 2 seconds later, there was a burst of gamma rays that was observed by the Fermi gamma ray burst satellite, and the dramatic association for us between these two things happening within just a couple of seconds of each other suggested right away that the gamma ray burst was associated with the merger of this pair of neutron stars. Now, we'd never seen the gravitational waves or never measured gravitational waves from neutron stars before, but we had measured gamma ray bursts, and it had long been theorized that gamma ray bursts, short gamma ray bursts, were caused by the merger of pairs of neutron stars. But with this detection of the gravitational waves, we confirmed that. So we now know that the short gamma ray bursts are actually caused by the merger of neutron stars.
And then this led to, I think, pointing telescopes out there trying to look for something new up in the sky that might be this the visible results of a collision between two neutron stars?
Exactly, because when these two neutron stars collide with each other, they're about, each one is a little more than the same mass as the sun, and they're going near the speed of light. So when they crash into each other, they generate this huge explosion, and they cause all sorts of material to fly off away from where they collide. In that process, they generate a lot of energy. They, in fact, it turns out, it was theorized that they would generate some of the heavier elements that exist in the universe through a mechanism known as the R process. So things like gold, platinum, uranium would be generated in this explosion that follows the collision of the neutron stars. At the same time, the material heats up and it gives off light. And so what we were doing with our partner astronomers was we sent them what we guessed to be the likely location of the neutron star merger on the sky. It was somewhere in the constellation Hydra. And they took their telescopes and started to search over the sky looking for something that was getting brighter, something that hadn't been there before on the night sky. And sure enough, the 1 meter Carnegie Swope telescope found a little tiny bright dot near a galaxy with kind of the telephone number NGC 4993. And that little dot turned out to be, after confirmation, associated with the merger of the neutron stars. So now we know both about the merger through the gravitational waves. We saw the gamma rays that were emitted right away afterwards, and about 11 hours after the merger, we saw this bright optical point on the sky, which told us exactly which galaxy the merger had happened in.
Now, you mentioned the date, August 17th, I think it was.
Yep, that's
now,
right.
Most of us here on the ground weren't aware that anything was going on, but as I'm reading about this, it seems like in astronomy, this is a breaking point. This is a dividing point. Things have changed now in our understanding of the universe.
Absolutely. This was pretty much one of the most exciting breakthroughs in astronomy in a long time. I was walking around the streets of Amsterdam with my wife at the time when I got the notification on my cell phone, and I was just, oh my gosh, what's this? And she was, what's wrong? And I had to explain, it was just one of the biggest discoveries in astronomy for quite some time. So it's been, it really is a breakthrough. Being able to see both the gravitational waves and the electromagnetic or the light from these objects means that we learn all sorts of new things that we couldn't do before. One of my favorites is that because we saw the flash of gamma rays and we saw the gravitational waves just 2 seconds apart, we know that gravitational waves travel very, 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 very close to the speed of light, within 1 part in 10 to the power of 15. Now, 10 to the power of 15 is about 0.1 trillion, okay? So this is 1 part in 0.1 trillion parts that these actually travel at the same speed. We knew that right away. On August 16th, we didn't know it. On August 17th, we did.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks very much, Rob. Have a good day.
We've been talking to Patrick Brady, director of the Center for Gravitation, Cosmology, and Astrophysics at UW-Milwaukee. He was with us to talk about the role UWM scientists have played in recent discoveries of gravitational waves coming from cataclysmic events in space. First, changes could be coming to a major international nuclear deal. On Friday, President Trump announced he would not continue to certify the Iran nuclear agreement, but stopped short of pulling out of the deal altogether. Here's a listen to the president speaking on Friday.
By his own terms, the Iran deal was supposed to contribute to regional and international peace and security. And yet, while the United States adheres to our commitment under the deal, the Iranian regime continues to fuel conflict, terror, and turmoil throughout the Middle East and beyond.
With the announcement, Trump is putting the pressure on Congress and U.S. allies to strengthen the agreement. He's also threatening to terminate the deal if those conditions cannot be met.
Valerie Lindsay joins us now. She's executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. Valerie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So the president didn't leave the deal, but he didn't recertify it. What does that mean exactly?
Exactly. Well, it's not sure exactly what that means. What he has said is that there are issues with the agreement itself that he would like to see corrected. There are issues outside of the agreement that are a grave threat to U.S. national security with regard to Iran that he would like to see addressed. And if those issues are not addressed, he doesn't feel that staying within the nuclear agreement is in the U.S. interest. And so we're at this point now where people are trying to figure out whether improvements or additions to the agreement can satisfy the administration, and therefore the administration would continue to adhere to the agreement.
This is a fairly complicated agreement, Valerie,
yeah.
But can you tell us what is inside and outside? What did it cover, and what issues raised by the president are not covered in that agreement?
Yeah, this is quite important. The agreement is narrowly focused on Iran's nuclear program, and so what the agreement does is it places restrictions on certain parts of Iran's nuclear program for a period of time, and after that period of time, Iran is allowed, with inspections, to have a much broader nuclear program. In exchange for accepting these restrictions, Iran was granted sanctions relief, specific relief from specific U.S., European, and UN sanctions. That is what the agreement covers. What the agreement does not cover is Iran's ballistic missile program. It does not cover Iran's destabilizing activities in the region and beyond. It does not cover Iran's human rights record. So those are issues that were mentioned by the president on Friday, but they are not explicitly dealt with by the agreement.
Why weren't those in the original agreement?
Because the parties would not have been able to come to any agreement at all if they had been included. Iran clearly would not compromise on many of these issues because it feels that its interest is different from the U.S. interest in Iraq and Syria and Yemen. So no agreement at all would have been reached had all of those issues been included in it. The ballistic missile question, I think, is a little bit more troublesome. Organizations like ours argue that ballistic missiles are an inherent part of a nuclear weapon program and should have been dealt with in the agreement, but they weren't. In order to reach a compromise, ballistic missiles were left out.
Is it realistic to go back to the bargaining table at this point, do you think, and maybe expand the initial agreement to include things like ballistic missiles?
I think that's a question. I mean, that's clearly what the administration is trying to do. For my part, I think it depends on how much exactly they want to pile on to the agreement. You might be able to look at things like ballistic missiles or the so-called sunset provisions within the agreement, the fact that some of those restrictions I mentioned expire after a period of time, and it may be that the parties to the agreement could come to some sort of an accommodation on those issues. I think that if you try and put too much on the back of the agreement, like Iran's activities in the region, for instance, seems very, very unlikely that could be achieved. And if the president requires that in order to continue staying in the agreement, then I think he's likely to decide to pull out.
We're talking to Valerie Lindsay, executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, looking at the announcement last Friday from the White House that the U.S. would not recertify the nuclear arms agreement with Iran. Not entirely clear what that means in practice. Valerie, let's look at the issues covered by the agreement, nuclear weapons development. You wrote recently that we could sure use more transparency when it comes to what we know and don't know about what Iran is and isn't doing. What did you mean by that?
Well, the president is making a series of assertions about violations, about compliance, and we've been arguing for some time that there's not enough information in the public domain to really be able to evaluate those claims. So has Iran really violated the agreement as the president has said? Or are the problems of a different sort? So we've argued for more information, more public information about the nuclear inspections taking place in Iran, more information about there's this sort of joint commission that oversees the implementation of the agreement. The U.S. is a party to that commission. Iran is a party to that commission. So what is that commission doing? What is it deciding on? What inspections is it authorizing? Is it allowing inspectors or endorsing inspectors access to military sites, for instance? There are a series of sort of issues in the way that the agreement is operating that for those of us on the outside, we really have no visibility into exactly how they're functioning.
Is that maybe something that makes the deal possible for Iran, saying, okay, we'll let you do these inspections, but we don't want all this information in the public domain, in effect?
It's possible that would be, I mean, that's one possible solution. I think the point here is that there are mechanisms within the agreement to try and deal with some of the issues that the president raised. And it's not clear to those of us on the outside whether the administration is really investing in and trying to get a resolution to the issues within those mechanisms. I mean, it requires really an investment in the agreement. And as we saw on Friday, and as we've heard today, it's not clear that the administration, that the president, is really interested in making that investment.
What are some of your areas of concern when it comes to inspections in Iran? What are areas that we don't know because there isn't this transparency you're looking for, but that would worry you about where Iran could be violating the agreement without us knowing?
Well, there are areas. The agreement prevents Iran from doing a series of activities related to nuclear weapons development in particular, and it's not clear exactly how the the international inspectors are confirming that Iran is not doing those things, because inspectors generally are looking at nuclear material. They're not looking at some of these other things that are captured by the nuclear weapon activities. And so more information about exactly how inspectors are verifying that Iran is not working with high explosives or working with high-speed cameras that could be used for a nuclear weapons test, that's important for the agency for the International Atomic Energy Agency to explain. And it's important for us to know that those inspections, that verification is happening. At this point, we really don't.
And another concern, as I understand it, is whether inspectors have access to specifically military research facilities in Iran.
That's correct. That is one of the areas. So this type of nuclear weapons work that I mentioned could be taking place in a laboratory at a university. It could be taking place at a military site. It could be taking place in a number of locations. Inspectors' ability to access military sites is one of several areas that needs to be resolved.
Now, the president made this announcement, and a lot of people are reading this as putting it now in the hands of Congress and European allies, who also, it's important to note, signed on to this agreement. What could Congress or European allies do to meet the White House's concerns here?
Well, Congress is taking up, is looking at possible legislation that would essentially set down a series of markers, and if the markers weren't attained, it would trigger the reimposition of sanctions. So if the international nuclear inspectors are able to access or are not able to access military sites, for instance, within a certain amount of time, that could trigger the reimposition of sanctions and a series of measures like that. So Congress could take the action of trying to sort of deal with the problems that the president raised on Friday. Congress could also fail to reach a consensus and do nothing. That is a possibility. It's sort of unclear at this point exactly what Congress will do. The other parties to the agreement have been universally critical of the president's announcement, including the European Union and European countries party to the agreement. They are committed to the framework of the nuclear agreement. Some of the countries have shown a willingness to work with the United States to try and get improvements on the margins of the agreement, but they all have said that they are committed to the framework of the nuclear agreement.
Are there mechanisms in the agreement itself that say, okay, if Iran violates these terms, these sanctions can be reimposed?
It is a rather blunt instrument, the reimposition of sanctions. So essentially, there's no kind of proportionality. If Iran is considered to have made a material breach and the parties can't remedy the problem, there is a mechanism to allow the sanctions to snap back. But there's no distinction between a major breach and a minor breach in this snapback scenario.
We're talking right now with Valerie Lindsay, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. We're talking about President Trump's announcement last week that he'll be effectively decertifying or declining to recertify the international nuclear deal with Iran. We're looking at what that could mean for the two countries going forward.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. How should the United States proceed on any nuclear agreement with Iran? Do you agree with the president that the current deal is flawed and needs reform, or is the deal in place doing its job? Let us know what you think by calling 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing our conversation with Valerie Lindsay, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. We're talking about the international nuclear deal with Iran and President Trump's threat to pull out of the deal if Congress and U.S. allies do not agree to reform and strengthen it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see out of a deal with Iran? Do you think the current deal is working, or does it not go far enough to stop the country's nuclear ambitions? What questions do you have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. We've got Brian on the line in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. Everybody says that we can't inspect military sites, but I thought I heard this morning that if there was proof or suspicion that they were developing nuclear weapons on military sites, the deal says that we could inspect it, and Iran couldn't essentially say no. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Brian, thanks. Valerie, is that right? The inspectors have the right to inspect military sites in Iran?
That's right. The agreement has allows for inspection of what they call sort of undeclared sites that are not part of Iran's declared nuclear facilities. The agreement does have sort of a series of procedures that can take place to allow inspectors access to such sites.
Thanks a lot for the question, Brian. I want to look at the deal as a whole. Valerie, President Trump has repeatedly referred to the Iran deal as one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. A couple years out, how do you evaluate the deal, the Iran nuclear deal, as far as success or failure goes?
I would say it has been a success if you define success narrowly, in that it has successfully restricted the most worrisome parts of Iran's nuclear program, and Iran has largely complied with those restrictions, and the other aspects of the agreement have functioned. I think there was an aspirational goal of the agreement, which was to sort of improve relations with Iran, to work on a host of other issues of concern between the United States and Iran. On that level, it has not succeeded, and I would say that was the case prior to the arrival of the Trump administration. It was the case in the Obama administration. So I would say narrow success broadly hasn't achieved what was hoped. And the question now is really to figure out the balance, and does what is achieved outweigh sort of the costs that the administration clearly sees in continuing to adhere to it?
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. John is on the line in Menominee Falls. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for receiving my call. I listened to a public radio announcement the other day where they were talking about how the European allies, or the multinational group who was doing the inspections, had said that Iran had met all of the parts of the agreement that were listed with the Obama administration. And I pretty much believe what they said. And secondly, if you go back to Trump's history as a businessman, he spent huge amounts of his career trying to get out of contracts he signed with people, and was sued numerous times by people for his dealings in contracts. So it seems like he just has a phobia against actually going through with a contract anyone signed.
John, thanks for the call. So, Valerie, as far as we can tell, it sounds like Iran has officially met all the stipulations of the agreement?
Yes. Again, I think that you can look at things sort of narrowly and literally or more broadly, but I think that there is agreement that on the sort of narrow interpretation, even the administration agrees that Iran is, as I think Secretary Tillerson said, in technical compliance with the agreement. So that is not under dispute.
And then he was kind of questioning President Trump's motives in wanting to get out of the deal. I mean, is there a case to be made that by trying to renegotiate, we might get more leverage on Iran and be able to roll in maybe the ballistic missiles, maybe interference in other countries in the Middle East into a bigger agreement?
There's clearly a hope to exploit what the administration sees as kind of a leverage point here. It's unclear to me whether that will be successful, because we saw the reaction of the Europeans, basically the partners that we would need really to have this broader strategy on the missiles and the other issues. So it's unclear whether the leverage strategy will work, but that is the hope of the administration.
We're talking to Valerie Lindsay from the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, looking at Iran, President Trump not recertifying the nuclear agreement with Iran, and what happens next. Back to your calls now. Peter is on the line in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I hope that Trump doesn't reimpose the sanctions and that we stick with the Iran deal. I think the biggest thing that's missing out of this whole debate is the context of why Iran is going for a nuclear weapon and why they view us as an enemy. If you look back at the history of Iran, with the Iran-Iraq war, where we supported Saddam Hussein, we used chemical weapons against them, and look at what a coup that happened in their country in 1979 and why they have an Islamic Revolution government rather than a non-theocratic government. It makes sense why they're opposed to us. I think the thing that we should do is try to not do sanctions and incorporate our economy in with theirs, because eventually they are going to get a nuclear weapon because they have too many educated people that eventually I think they will get it.
Peter, I want to jump in because that's a lot there already. First of all, Iran, suspicious of the United States as a negotiating partner, hard to get him to the table in the first place, I imagine, Valerie.
Yes, it was the work of over a decade before this agreement was concluded. I mean, the Europeans started negotiating with Iran on their own in 2003 when the scope of Iran's secret work came to light. So this has been a long time coming, this agreement.
And then another point Peter made was Iran's going to end up with a nuclear weapon eventually anyway. I imagine from where you're sitting, you don't accept that as inevitable.
I don't accept it as inevitable, but I would say that Peter makes a very good point, which is that there's a certain amount of inherent capability that Iran has developed. It has developed the ability to enrich uranium, and enriched uranium is one of the materials that can be used to fuel nuclear weapons. So there has been a sort of inherent capability that Iran has developed. It has a broad scientific base. So it's certainly within the realm of the possible, technically speaking. So then you have the question of how do you construct a framework to prevent it from happening, to decrease the motivation on the part of Iran to actually develop nuclear weapons.
And then finally, Peter, worried about sanctions being reimposed if the United States, say if Congress decided, yeah, we're going to go ahead with sanctions again, what does that do to the deal with Iran?
If Congress pursues non-nuclear sanctions, sanctions on ballistic missiles, terrorism, etc., it is not a violation of the nuclear agreement. Congress already adopted those sanctions in August and could do more similar sanctions and try and bring the Europeans on board for similar sanctions and other like-minded countries. If Congress reimposes the sanctions that were waived as part of the nuclear agreement, that would be basically the end of the nuclear agreement because Iran would object. It was one of the main benefits to the country.
Looking ahead now, Valerie, what are you hoping comes out of all this?
What comes out of all this? It's hard to say exactly where we go from here. I hope that this doesn't become too much of a distraction, this question of certification and decertification, because in a sense, the Trump administration has put the nuclear agreement at the center of its Iran policy in a way that the Obama administration did, and the overall Iran policy should be much broader. My hope is that the administration focuses on the real improvements to the agreement that could be made within the framework of the agreement, the points that I've made previously on increasing transparency, the points on using the mechanisms of the agreement to get access to military sites if needed, as one of the other callers raised. These sorts of things I think we could do within the agreement, and we could do with the support of other parties to the agreement. If the administration decides that it's going to load every grievance it has against Iran and try and resolve all of those in order to continue with the nuclear agreement, I think it's a losing scenario for nonproliferation, and I think it's a losing scenario for our ability to sort of rally the world behind a campaign to sanction Iran.
We'll leave it there for now. Valerie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Valerie Lindsay. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. She joined us to talk about President Trump's announcement late last week that he would not recertify the international nuclear deal with Iran, and looking at what that can mean for both countries going forward.